You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode number 32 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast. We broadcast on Middle Earth Network Radio as well as on the Star Wars Report website. Our episodes are also available on our own Facebook page at facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. But enough about how you got here, let's get the show started. I am one of your hosts, Nathan P. Butler. With me, as always, the defender of the EU, my stalwart companion, Mr. Mark Herleman. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Nathan. Everybody else, me and Whistler are here. Happy to be here. In the process of moving Echo Base. It's been a chaotic 2 weeks, we'll say. So, in the meantime, I'm leaving the studio set up at the old place as we move and shift and sort some more at the new place before I'm able to get the new studio set up. So, it'll be interesting. I'm slowly converting the entire room to the studio instead of half bedroom, so that's kind of cool at least.
That's good. Yeah, we're moving as well. Not the house, but moving classrooms and such. We're recording this during what we call pre-planning, which is that insanely chaotic period prior to the students actually showing up for the first day of school, wherein it seems like there's way too much to get done. None of it will get done, only you realize once day one comes around that about 99% of it actually somehow did get done.
Yeah. Yes, Whistler, you're right. Here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, we ask the tough questions. Questions that have bothered you for a long time, or simple ones that have perplexed you off and on. Heck, sometimes we talk about things you don't even know about. You ponder about Star Wars, and so do we. This episode, we look at the first four stories of the new Lost Tribe of the Sith, The Collected Stories. That's by John Jackson Miller. Great set of books, I'm here to say. It was recently collected again in a paperback premium format, along with Pandemonium. Well, consider this your spoiler warning, because here we go.
That's right, we are taking a look at the first four stories that were originally presented in ebook form for free, which are Precipice, Skyborn, Paragon, and Savior. Of course, the latter stories we're going to cover next time around, those include Purgatory, Sentinel, Pantheon, Secrets, and then the one that is exclusive to that new The Collected Stories paperback entitled Pandemonium, which is longer than any of the other individual stories. For what it's worth, we're looking at a stretch time frame here. The first of these stories, Precipice and Skyborn, both take place in 5000 BBY, near the end of the Great Hyperspace War seen in the Golden Age of the Sith and Fall of the Sith Empire comic book series from Tales of the Jedi, and of course during, or at least part of it, during the beginning of the earlier point of Cross Current, which we've talked about. Then we jump ahead by 15 years for Paragon, and then another 10, so a 25-year span, for Savior.
You know, I will say, the fact that it came in the premium trade, I was a little hesitant. You know, I'm always all about my bookshelf, which, you know, I've shared pictures on our Facebook page. But this one actually fit on the shelf. It was surprised to me. I mean, they're supposed to be the same size as the other ones, but I believe this one was just small enough that it slid in, where the other ones, the Clone Wars one, Siege, Gambit, and all that, didn't quite do it for me. Wild Space, I believe, was one of the others. I was really excited about the fact that it fit on my bookshelf, because the fact they were doing a trade, you know, these premium styles, I didn't like the first ones, and I wasn't too keen on this one, but the fact that it fit in the end really tickled me. So that was cool. And like you said, you know, it does the 5,000 years before, and I like how in the first story, Precipice, you know, it's more about the Sith point of view, and then the second one, Skyborn, is about the Kreshiri, what was her name? Adari. Adari, it was kind of her point of view, what was going on there. But, you know, we here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, we look at the grander EU. And I like also how this played in with the scenes from Cross Current. You know, and plus you've got the Tales of the Jedi stuff that Nathan had mentioned earlier. But when you knew what was going on with CS and his crew, and you apply that to this, it gives you that little bit of insight when Coruscant, you know, Captain Coruscant is pondering what's going on with CS, it's like, you know. And that's kind of cool. I like that kind of stuff. It's not anything necessary to the story, but it's there for those that have taken the time and they get the extra enjoyment out of it. But I really got a kick out of Coruscant's character. And I will say, you know, in the overall, with these first four stories, they're definitely Coruscant's story. And I really enjoyed his point of view, his character, and as his character kind of dealt with the hand that was given him.
Yeah, these first four stories really wrap together very well. They essentially, it's almost like what we have is essentially sort of a three-part saga, where the first three parts are mostly confined just to the stories that we get in these first four ebooks. They make up the Corson family line, the Corson story, both for Yarrow Corson, his brother Devore, I guess half-brother Devore, Devore Corson, and then Sela, who was at one point the wife of Either, and then their children as it moves along. Then we have a big time jump, which brings us to the second set of four, which have their own time jumps within, until finally at the very end, we get Pandemonium. From a format standpoint, since you had mentioned the format here, I like the look of the book. It's nice, it's thick, it's good that we didn't have to pay a hardback price for it. I don't think that this much content would have easily fit into a standard paperback, but at the same time, I know there's going to be those out there who are griping that it's not one of those formats, the same way as we have issues in some cases with, say, those Clone Wars books like Wild Space and the Gambit books and such. There's also, of course, the issue here with price. Going back to the EU review roots here, we've talked a lot, or I've talked a lot in various podcasts about whether certain things are worth the money, and this one's a tricky one because 8 of the 9 stories are stories that were available for free, either online, through the Kindle bookstore, through the Nook bookstore, and so on. There's only one story, and a couple of maps, really, that were not otherwise available elsewhere for free, and that's Pandemonium. And Pandemonium winds up being, I think they originally advertised it as a 90-page story, winds up being something more like 120 or something like that, but the book's price tag is $12. So unless you have an Amazon-type discount, if you're buying it from a retailer that automatically discounts to help make up for shipping costs and that sort of thing to get you to buy from them, you're basically looking at about a dime a page. And that's a little bit high relative to what we see with quite a few paperback books out there right now. I think it was worth it. I like the fact that we can have it all in one place, and now new readers can read through it all as one story. And if you don't have an ebook reader, you don't have to read this off the computer screen, which is a complaint that I heard a lot when they were first released exclusively as ebooks. So I think this is a good purchase to pick up. It definitely is something that feels different when you read it straight through. I would almost take this as sort of one of those historical readers, because it's jumping generation to generation, and unlike most of Star Wars, where it seems like no matter what generation you're in, the technology is very, very similar, in this case, we have the Lost Tribe, this group of Sith that start out as Red Sith and Masasi and human that wind up just being humans. When they crash land on Kesh, they can't get away. So it's essentially, instead of being, I guess you could almost say that instead of being the same technology as everywhere else, it starts at the same technology, and it almost has like a U shape if we were going to graph their technology. It's like their technology starts with whatever they came with, but as that wears out, runs out of power, they have generations that forget how to use it and such, their technology drops and drops and drops, and now near the end, they're finally, as we get to Pandemonium, they're going to be finally building that back up, trying to figure out how do we go between continents and stuff like that. So it's really kind of cool that we see the technology curve when most Star Wars stories don't give us that.
I liked how Corson had, there was a point in the story where Corson's thinking about how they used all their flares and a couple bits of their technology all in attempts to try to get off the planet, even though he knew that it was all futile, and he was just like thinking back on like, what a waste, you know, I could really use that now. And that was the cool thing about it, because Kresh had no precious metals. You know, they had hard stones, marbles, things like that, but really no metal at all. And that was the big hitch for him. But, you know, you mentioned map, and I like the fact that it had the map at the front. That was something I always enjoyed about the New Jedi Order later books, how they all had the maps and stuff. And it gave it a very Tolkien feel almost, how you flip it open and there's that map at the front. And it kind of, you know, I remember when I was reading Paragon, I was trying to think where the mountains they were talking about were. But you find out in like the second or third story that they were named after Corson's mom, the Takara Mountains. And that's, I was like, oh, okay. But the first part, you know, I'm like, where are they at? I was totally guessing it was the other mountain range at first. I'm like, well, what'd they do? Like hook around or something? Because that one's not okay. But I really enjoyed that they have the map. That's something that I hope Del Rey does in a lot more of their stories. You know, I've always said the galaxy maps are cool. And if you have a story that's set in one spot in the galaxy, to have the little zoom in on it, that was always a cool little feature, you know, and I would love to see them bring that back. And this brought it back to a degree. And you mentioned price. And I will say that I was surprised to find out there that you could find copies of this book for $7 and or, you know, around that price, like $6.96 plus a little shipping and handling. But that surprised me because, you know, it is a $12 cover book if you got it at top price, at, you know. And so if you shop around online, you can always find a little score here or there. But it was one of those things that I definitely was checking that out as to seeing, you know, are there any deals out there? Because, you know, Amazon always does an occasional thing and stuff like that. But getting back to the story and how you mentioned the Red Sith, you know, I love how the atmosphere of the planet or whatever it was in general was deadly to them. And through these first four stories, you have kind of that aspect of the Sith conflict going on, where you have the traditional Sith of old, the Red Sith caste, and you've got the new non-pureblood versions that have come in that the Sith have kind of Mandalorian style adopted, and you're watching the humans come and rise, in a sense. It's almost like Planet of the Apes for these poor Red Sith, you know.
But it wasn't the Red Sith who had a reaction to the atmosphere. The people who died were the Massassi.
I keep thinking Red Sith with that.
The Red Sith, and I think this is the first time we ever heard that phrase Red Sith for their race. We get the sense that, oh, well, it's like the Massassi. You know, after 25 years, there's hardly any of them left because, well, there's just something with the atmosphere. They keep having children, but the children keep dying right after they're born. It must be something with the atmosphere. Surely it can't be something that's part of someone's plan. And as we find, probably the most devious character in this entire first four stories is not one of the males. We get Cela Corson, who had a child, Geriad, with Devore Corson, who was the less advanced as far as rank goes, the less advanced of the two Corson half-brothers. And when it looks like Devore is going to wind up causing trouble for the Sith when they first arrive on the planet, Yeru is faced with a choice after battling his brother. You know, I either let him fall to his death or I save him. And you know what? For the greater good of myself and the community, screw him and lets him die. And
well, and there was that whole question of what him and Sado had talked about, you know, and that was kind of built into it, too. It was like, everything, you know, the brother had tried to do to kind of take command of Omen out from underneath him, because Omen was a namesake in a sense, as Corson inherited it or stole it, if you will, from his father after leaving because his father brought in that stepbrother. I love the dynamic of the families here.
Yeah, and essentially what Cela is like this. I mean, I was going to say she's sort of like the bridge between the two brothers, but if she is, she's like a burning bridge between the two brothers, because this is a woman who, her and her son by Devore, or Devore.
I call them Devore.
They're going to spend their time essentially biding their time to find a chance to get revenge on Yeru, whereas it's almost like it's almost like a Hamlet type situation where Cela now is essentially the widow who then marries the brother of the man she was with before. She winds up marrying Yeru, so they have sort of this unified front of power over the society. But she's biding her time, and when she has a child with Yeru, you have Nida Corson being born, and now you've got this half-brother, half-sister type thing going on with Geriad and Nida of that next generation, who in and of themselves are sort of picking favorites as far as parents go and what they're going to do. Whose side are they going to be on when it finally comes to blows, when Cela finally tries to get her revenge a good quarter of a century later? So the idea of the Sith biding their time, we see it in Yeru. You know, he knows they're in this for the long haul. They cannot get off the planet. You see it in Cela. She has these long-range plans for revenge. It seems like in a lot of ways, though, the other aspect of the Sith, the infighting and the lust for power and the fact that they just can't freaking get over themselves and work together, seems to be what we wind up seeing with many of the other Sith in these stories, particularly in the conflict between the human Sith, who are essentially Sith, I guess, in allegiance, and the Red Sith, who are Sith by species, and the struggle between those two sides over ideology. Essentially, you know, we should settle down and stay here because we just practically can't get off the planet. Or, no, we should be trying to get off the planet, dang it, even if there's no freaking way we can do it. They're so obsessed with that idea. We must get off the planet. We must rejoin the fight, even when they can't, that they're not able to see past that issue to future survival. He does a really good job of putting these characters in situations where you're sitting there going, really? Are you crazy? To the characters, and yet it perfectly fits in with the mindset we would expect from characters who've grown up, who've lived within a Sith, not even meritocracy, but essentially a Sith feudal culture almost, where it's all about who can advance, who can look better over the others, and it's not about can we reach the goal, it's can I screw you over on the way to the goal. He does a great job with this.
Sela especially was a character I really enjoyed. You know, she kept track of the genealogy, she kept track of the birthing, you know, all these different aspects, and it all worked into her plan. The other thing about her, though, is her character provided us a point of view into the Sith culture and back into Tales of the Jedi. She was the foot washer of Ludo Kresh, and that gave her an interesting perspective because she saw Kresh's viewpoint, and he had foreseen that if the Sith left their home Nebula, that the Red Sith would no longer be the Sith and that the humans would, in a sense, become the new Sith. He foresaw that happening. And so that's what played into a lot of her plot I mean, she had like three or four plots running at one point. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, when she set Ravelin up, the Red Sith that was the Messiah handler, the way she set him up and had Coruscant in the end butcher him and the rest of the Red Sith because of what they did, the genocide that they had set into motion that you find out that they didn't quite set in motion by themselves, that she had a hand in it. I was blown away by that. You know, the whole Coruscant family, that dynamic was a really cool part. By the time you get to the fourth story and what's been going on with Nida is just, it was mind-boggling. I mean, Jaraid was a little punk, you know. I love the fact that Coruscant would look at him and see Devar on his face. You know, there were certain times where his dad's features would kind of overwrap him, and he wanted to kind of reach out and throttle him, you know, and how he had actually in the end had set up a trap. I mean, the fourth book was like trap on trap on trap, springing action, and it was really fun. The first three, they definitely set it up well. You know, like we mentioned, the first chapter was all about how the Sith had first crashed and how, you know, what they were going to do. And it kind of ends with, you know, Coruscant kills his brother, but he also sees someone on the winged beast, the Uvok. Am I saying that right?
Uvok. I always say Uvok. Yeah.
Yeah, the Uvok, which I liked how the Uvok played a key in the culture, which plays into chapter two where we got Adari's point of view, and she's kind of like a heretic because she's thinking outside the box. You know, they're a very religious caste type system, and levels are really what it's all about. I mean, literally in your latitude, like if you live down in, let's say Coruscant for you EU fans out there, better understanding. If you lived in the underworld, you're just the scum of the earth. But if you're living up in the lofty Coruscant area, that you're the cream of the crop, and you can't transition. I mean, once you get knocked down, you can't come back up, kind of thing. And yet we see the opposite because of what happened with the Sith. So in the first two chapters, it's almost like the same time frame just being seen from two points of view. And I liked how that played together. By the time you get to Paragon, that's when you finally start seeing what the Sith culture is like at this point. I mean, again, we see Sela's point of view, and that's where she actually gets into, you know, life with Ludo Kresh and what that was like and how now they finally got hot water and she's got these servants and everyone sees them as gods because of this deal that Coruscant had struck with Adari, and this deal elevates her because she's like the ambassador now to the gods. And I mean, I really liked how, in a sense, that they were totally snickering on the Kreshi society. They didn't have a clue they were being played, and it brings you to that lost, or the Tales of the Sith, where, you know, the Dark Jedi first came and took over the Sith. It was kind of like that whole thing reenacting. But meanwhile, you had what it came before. It was a very complex dynamic that I really enjoyed. You know, knowing all these things that I did, it was a kick because it wasn't mentioned, and yet there it was for you that if you had read this stuff, you knew about it, and it was like, connecting the dots. Oh, there's a big picture here. God bless you, John Jackson Miller. I love your novels.
There's a lot of definitely wheels within wheels to this one. I mean, you've got, you mentioned all the different plots coming in during Savior. You know, you've got the idea of, oh, well, it wasn't so much that the Red Sith were dying because of a disease. It was because, well, Sela had made herself essentially the lead midwife, and she's going to make sure that they all die by her hand so that they can't grow. And well, we need to get off the planet because the Red Sith aren't going to survive if we don't get off the planet. If they can't have kids, they're going to die out. So the Red Sith need to push things. We're going to let loose a disease based on this stuff that we've got. And if we put it in water, it winds up making people sick. So see, we're all going to die. We got to get off the planet only for Sela to wind up using that then to set up Ravelin Roth, the leader of the Red Sith, to essentially have them be punished and wiped out, as you mentioned. A lot of definitely wheels within wheels, even with Adari. I mean, Adari is, at least in the second book, or the second ebook, the second chapter, whatever you want to call it, at least within the span of Skyborn, she's sort of our perspective character from outside the Sith culture. Most of our perspective characters, at least for the first half of this series, are within Sith culture, usually being the humans within Sith culture. Adari is a Kashyyri. She's native to Kesh, or Keshta, this particular continent of Kesh. And we'd like to think that we know all of her motivations, because we get to see her perspective on what it is that she sees when she first meets the Sith, what she believes about Yaru and them, what the religious beliefs are of the community with the Skyborn, the whole idea of the Protectors and the Destructors, and how the Protectors defeated the Destructors, or it was Destroyers, whatever, defeated them, but wound up being injured, and their blood became the different islands out there and all that kind of stuff. There's this mythology around it, and she can give us a perspective on both the Sith and her own culture, because while she is part of the culture that has those beliefs, she herself is saying, no, the islands, you know, they come from, you know, volcanic activity and things like that. She's more of a science-oriented individual, which lets her have a different perspective on the Sith. She can see them sort of for what they are rather than them coming in and playing, I guess you could take the Stargate example, coming in and playing the Gua'uld and saying, you know, we are gods. In a sense, what the Sith are doing here is, in order to be accepted and not wind up having to clash with the native Kashyyri, they're pulling a Luke on Endor. They're saying, here, tell them if you become angry, you'll use your magic. You know, just like Luke lifts up C-3PO yeah. in order for the Ewoks to chill and accept them as more divine beings, even though C-3PO really isn't, here are the Sith doing the same thing to the Kashyyri. The only difference being that there's no sense that the Sith ever changed that. In fact, as we go along, there's a couple of things that we'll find in these first stories that significantly tie into Pandemonium with regard to the truth about Adari, what winds up happening to her, and bits and pieces about the way that whole mythology plays out with the Skyborn. But even as we're getting her as a perspective character, we're expecting her to be the one person that we can sort of trust the point of view from. Yeah, the Sith, we can trust that they're believing what they say they're believing about themselves when they're in their own heads, but when they're acting, who knows what aim they're actually acting toward? You know, who knows whose back they're going to stab next? With Adari, to wind up finding by the end of Paragon that there is a local Kashyyri resistance, and one of the primary figures is Adari. That sort of turns our perceptions of her a little bit on their head and set up Savior so that Savior winds up being something with, you sort of had your three factions. You've got Yaru's faction, you've got Sela's faction, I guess four. You got the Red Sith and you've got the local resistance, and all of those sort of clashing come to a head. He's almost sort of setting up here, in a sense, kind of the classic Star Wars story without being able to change locations. I always used to say that when it comes to a Star Wars film, especially, if you really want to get the feel of it, you got to do kind of like what Timothy Zahn did with his Thrawn trilogy. You got to have multiple locations, multiple battles going on, or characters sent out on multiple paths, so that in the end, it all ties together and multiple conflicts happen at once. You know, like the Battle of Endor has Luke on the Death Star, has Han and his team down on the ground, and has Lando and his group up in space, and yet it's all part of the same climax because the story has weaved them all together to bring them all to that same point. Here, they can't be in a lot of different places. You only got the one location. Most of this stuff takes place in Tav or at the Omen crash site. But instead of having different places, we have different factions who we've been following for these four ebooks, only for the end to finally wind up being a twisted web of plots where each one meets maybe not its fate, in some cases its fate, but they each meet some turning point that alters fundamentally what the Lost Tribe is going forward, who the Kashiri are going forward, and there's even consequences we don't even know about, again, until we get to the end with things like Pandemonium showing us some more of the ramifications from this. So he does a good job of giving us a Star Wars feeling tale while sort of turning the paradigm of a Star Wars tale of multiple locations with one story on its head to now be multiple factions within one location.
Yeah, there's a lot of shifting gears, you know, like you mentioned. In Paragon, we also learned that that's, I mean, you don't learn, but you do. I mean, it's one of those things where it's all but said. Ravelin, that's when he finds out what's been going on with Sela and the younglings of his people and how she's been killing them all, kind of, in a sense. And then she, you know, basically she tells him, he goes, what kind of mother are you? And she goes, the mother of a people. Now, my son. And then her son, Gerard, he jumps out and stabs him with the lightsaber and kills him. And, you know, he's like, he's not the one I want to kill. And she goes, be patient. She said, stroking her son's hair, I have been. And, I mean, that's all you get, but it basically, it again, gives you the idea that, oh, something's coming down for poor Yaru Corson, you know. And that's what we see with the Corson plotline in the next chapter. But I really liked how Adari's chapter, you know, or storyline in Savior plays out. You know, she goes around and she collects all the Yuvok. She had Nanik, her Yuvok, it was the one that she ended up inheriting from her husband that had died. I mean, that all happened in her chapter in the second story, how you find out about how her husband had died and she inherited the Yuvok and she ends up riding it, and then later it ends up, you know, letting her ride it all the time. So at this point, it's the oldest one, and they're kind of a herd animal in a sense, and so she's going to try to round them all up and strand the Sith back on top of the planet or where the ship was, so they're stranded because the planet is so inaccessible that only having an Yuvok is the way to really get around, and how their little Kashyyyk Empire has grown is through the Yuvoks, and without them, you know, they're basically going to be all hosed and it'll take the Sith a long time to get there. But the way that even that plays out, there's another twist there, and it's family related. It's her own son who betrays her by giving the secret of what's going on with the rebellion to Nida, the Skyborn Rangers leader. The go-go Skyborn Rangers!
We got way too many Power Rangers-type jokes that we can make with stories lately.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, they set them up, we knock them down.
Is Nida the Pink Ranger? Going in with what you were saying there, it's funny because there's almost an irony to the way that story plays out. I guess irony. I always get tripped up on the actual definition of irony, other than the fact that it's not what Alanis Morissette said it was. but it's funny because the whole issue, the whole reason there was conflict between the Red Sith and the others, and why there was dissent within the human side of the Sith culture once they wind up stranded on Kesh, is that question of, can we leave or can we not? And even if we can't leave, shouldn't we be trying to find a way to do that? Maybe there's just something we have overlooked. So being stranded and the question of can they ever get out of there becomes the focal point of struggle within a society that already sort of thrives on struggle. And yet what winds up being the final motivation, the final act that Adari tries to take against the Sith? She's going to strand them again. You think being stuck on this planet was tough? We're going to strand you in these mountains on your own. And Sela, who of course is the one who is manipulating a lot of these events behind the scenes, winds up by the hand of her own daughter, who is much more loyal to her father than mother, since they're plotting against each other. She herself winds up in even smaller microcosm of that same idea, being essentially broken, somewhat paralyzed, and left essentially to die up in the mountains on her own when Nida takes the title of Grand Lord. So constantly there's this theme or this thematic element of being stranded on a smaller and smaller island, so to speak, and that being one of those great pains for the Sith. And it never would have occurred to me that a society who thrives so much on expansion and conquering, that the opposite of that would be the primary way of showing the society being harmed. You know, that it's the same, you know, if someone, their whole goal in life is to have children, and they wind up finding out that they can't, that's one of the worst blows that could possibly happen to them. The opposite of what they wanted in the broader scheme of things. For the Sith, I don't know what it was that I used to think must have been their greatest fear, maybe just being wiped out by the Jedi because of having separated during the Second Great Schism and such. But it seems like here he's really playing on the idea that being confined, bounded in a nutshell, as Hamlet might say, having their ambitions confined, that is the worst that can happen, because they're just going to be like a container of boiling water boiling over. There's so much energy, they're going to wind up destroying themselves and plotting against each other, because there's nowhere else to release that outlet of rage, that outlet of wanting to expand, that outlet of ambition. He plays on that well, and yet doesn't really... It's not like he calls attention to it. It's not like he says, hey, see, this is what I'm doing, waving, waving, waving. He makes it much more subtle, and I can really appreciate seeing themes that aren't slapped across our faces.
Yeah, I would say Yaru had that point of view when it came to the Sith being bottled up. I mean, that was kind of why he kept them structured and kept them moving, and why he actually lied and said he had sent off the beacon when the antenna was destroyed when he got there. He at least made it seem like he got one signal out, gave him a false hope. And, you know, at that time, only Adari knew about it. But Sela had suspicions, and she later ended up finding out 100%. And I can't exactly remember. It was something about she had been reading Adari's mind somehow and got it from Adari's mind. She had seen the memories that way. But another character, and it plays into Sela's being crippled, was Gloid. He was the last of the aliens on the planet, aside from the Krasheri themselves, to die. And when he died in the battle at the end... him and Yaru, they're, you know, doing their thing, and they kind of get separated. And, I mean, it was a great little battle, you know. I was really rooting them on. I was like, come on, dude, get out of there. And then you find out that he had a proton grenade, and he'd been hiding and holding on to this proton grenade the entire time they were there as a dead man switch, suicide, doomsday device. You know, it's like, you take me down, I'm going to take you all with me. And that was how Sela lost her legs, and I found that was pretty cool, because she had a death on for him and all the aliens from the start. I mean, she had a very Palpatine feel in her quest to put the humans above all. And I really liked her character. I mean, she was just a really mean Sith. And I'm using that in a term that is family friendly.
Well, it's funny because when I was reading Precipice initially, I really saw the conflict being between Devore or Devor. I keep having that Padme, Sabe, Corday, anything that ends with an E must end with A somehow. The conflict between Yaru and Devore, the two brothers, was going to be the primary conflict that we would see running through at least a few e-books in the series. And we sort of see that, of course, because it's the legacy of Devore's death that winds up pushing things between Sela and Yaru. But honestly, when Sela was first introduced, I was like, oh, here's this other little side character that's being tossed in, because somebody has to have some woman at their side. And if this is going to be an ancient society, of course, it's got to be someone who's second class in stature to the male and that sort of thing. I almost felt like she was there as a characterization tool for the Coarsen Men, not as a character in and of herself, because she didn't get a lot of play, really, in Precipice relative to the later books, only to wind up finding her role just sort of exploding throughout the ones that came later. I will say, though, that from the standpoint of a new reader to this series, I think it's better to read these all in one shot, because they were spread out as they came out. You know, they were coming out right around the time that each new book in Fate of the Jedi was coming out. And in that sense, it's easy to forget the little nuances and such. And there are some things in here where one nuance can make a difference in a later book in terms of how much we're able to appreciate certain events, certain character motivations and such. It made for good little stories as initially read. But definitely, if you have read these before and you're only now picking up The Lost Tribe of the Sith, the collected stories, and you're like, well, I'm just going to read Pandemonium because I read the others as ebooks already.
Oh, yeah, go back.
Go back. Because there are bits and pieces that you'll find that echo throughout the series, and it plays out well. It really kind of shocks me how little of this seems to have been planned by John Jackson Miller in the grand scheme of things. I mean, obviously, he planned out this particular series, you know, story to story to story, to connect those together. But he gave a recent interview in which a couple of things that he said was, you know, he didn't create the Lost Tribe. That was a creation of the writers of Fate of the Jedi. He just had the chance to embellish them. And when it comes to Spiral, the apparently only one story arc comic series that we're going to be getting for Lost Tribe of the Sith, that as of this time, I guess my copy of number one is on its way to me in the mail, he didn't know as of the time of writing Purgatory, or not Purgatory, of Pandemonium, as finishing up this series, that he was going to get a chance to write a comic series that continued onward from there. He only was able, during the editing process for the final touches, to realize, oh, well, now I'm going to write this comic series. He was able to go back and add little touches in here and there. For something that seems to work together so well, and to have given us such a great foundation for this society that winds up playing such a big role in Fate of the Jedi, and for something that's going to launch off a comic series, even if it's only short-lived, I'm surprised at how much a lot of this just feels like it was, you know, happy accidents, you know, fortunate things happening from time to time that by the course of a series of accidents winds up creating something that winds up being very cool. That's not to say that the whole series is amazing straight through. I think as a whole, it's really, really good. There were some segments that dragged, but they were after this first four ebooks point where there were points where I was like, is he just, you know, kind of like telling stories, jumping time because he's got a chance to? I should have known better with John Jackson Miller that that wasn't what he was doing, that this was building up to something later on. But it's almost like there's a reset button sort of hit when we jump a huge chunk of time into the future after this fourth book. So it could really, really be seen as essentially two or three separate tales together. But if you read it all at once, it plays out well. I think Sela's motivations especially, if you follow Sela and Adari from book to book to book, reading it in quick succession, you'll see how the character motivations are slowly revealed. You'll see how the different parallels within the Kashyyyk culture and Sith culture come to light very subtly, but they're there. It would be very easy to toss these aside and say, well, they were just free little ebooks, and not give them the same weight from a critical standpoint as we would to a full-blown novel. But if you put all these together, you essentially have a multi-generational, full-blown novel that gives you one story in the process of telling us multiple smaller stories. I'm quite impressed by the way this wound up working out, and I hope they do more of these. The only thing I can even think of that's similar to this is when they serialize stuff in Insider, like Emissary of the Void and Hero of Kartal, or you could sort of, I guess, compare it to something like Tales from Jabba's Palace or Tales from Mos Eisley, but those weren't so much short stories that continued over time so much as they stacked on top of each other like Skyborn and Precipice did. But this, if this is a precedent for where Star Wars ebooks and short story tie-ins can go, it is a very good precedent to have set. I'd like to see them do more like this. And for something that was, it felt like it was out of left field when we first learned about it, I'd like to think that's a pretty high compliment.
Yeah, I mean, I was one that when I got it, I was reading it on the computer, and I was like, this does kind of hurt my eyes. You know, and I've now got to the Kindle and on all that good stuff, and I've downloaded them again on the Kindle, and I take, when I go on camping trips, I bust out the first couple books. But when I learned that Pandemonium was going to come out and they were going to collect them, I was like, okay, I'm going to wait till I get them all and read them all again. And so I didn't read any more after I learned that. And I got to admit, I'm right there with you. I really think they play well as a collected series of stories. I like the history aspect of it. You know, as I said, Yaru Corson was a favorite character of mine. And I liked how Gloyd, you know, his partner kind of reminded me of Kirk and Spock. And by the time we get to the end and we get to chapter four, I'm going to read a part here. I really enjoyed it. You know, we get to see the Trump card. And that's how it starts. Corson had played as Trump. Nida's very existence, he knew, was part of Sela's game to keep herself and Jared close to the seat of power. Giving Corson a daughter was of use to Sela. Nida herself wasn't. Sela had, quote-unquote, caringly found a series of creshy nursemaidens and then tutors for the child, boarding her in one village after another. Officially, it was a gesture of Sith trust in the Kashyyyk. In truth, it reflected the hole he'd always known was in his wife's heart. There was more. Sela wasn't just getting Nida out of the way. Corson knew she was preventing her daughter from receiving anything more than superficial training in Sith ways. Sela kept the roles of Sith on Kresh. She knew where all potential mentors were at any time. And this is the part I love. But Corson had several loyal crew members willing to serve him in any role. With Gloyd's help, Corson had staged their deaths in remote areas of Kesh and sent them into hiding. All during the nights of Nida's seeming exile, the girl had been secretly had secretly been learning the ways of the dark side, even as, during the days, she was winning the Kreshiri friends and building a network of informants, all in her seemingly meaningless but very mobile role as Ariel Ambassador to the Sith. While Sela was striving to portray herself as the model Sith on Kresh, Corson had crafted a leader, someone with the talents to fight and to govern, an heir, and today, a savior.
She was training with the lost tribe of the Sith, apparently.
Yeah.
I think the whole idea, though, of it'd be very easy, put it this way, it would be very easy for, and some stories do this, for a villain of a story, if you want to call it that, or an antagonist, a rival character in a story, to be looked at from a narrative standpoint, especially when you're writing a third-person story, whether it's third-person limited, where you only see the point of view of the person that this particular segment is focused on, or it's just regular third-person where you can get into multiple heads all at the same time. A lot of times in narration that's not first-person, you see a focus on one character and their attitudes, their motivations, and the other character, the rival character, their actions get described, but not necessarily their motives, because you don't want to necessarily get into the other character's head while you're focusing on the other, which makes sense. But that isn't to say that you can't have a character that you're focusing on, maybe not knowing the motivations of another character, their rival character, but playing into the motivations of them trying to figure out what those motivations are. I mean, you just read, Yaru is looking at Nida and seeing motivations that aren't actually what her motivations are. But he's making his own rationalizations for her behavior as they go along. I like that because it gives us a chance to see both sides of this and not just, okay, well, the Sith are duping each other, but to what extent, in a sense, the Sith are duping themselves in some cases. You know, in looking towards their plots, their goals, what they want. In Yaru, for instance, deciding, you know, I'm so slick, I'm so smart for making sure that my daughter Nida is getting that Sith training even though Sela didn't want her to. He's also at the same time completely blind to the plot of Sela and Jeriad against him, or at least blind to the specifics of it, or to the extent of it.
Well, we know he did know it, though, because when he sprung his trap, how was it worded, that his enemies were brought out of the shadows or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, he recognizes that there's an enmity, there you go, there's an enmity there, but it's not so much that he's not recognizing where some of it's coming from. You know, oh, well, she is setting herself up to do this and this because there's a hole in her heart from this, that, and the other. He's ascribing things to her that really, if you go around and you turn it to her point of view, those things aren't really there. It's like if you're saying that a character's acting out of compassion when really all they're doing is trying to get favor with someone and they don't have any compassion in their heart at all, the actions are the same. But the motive and the perceived motive have a big disconnect, and sometimes we can delude ourselves, and that's essentially what we wind up seeing here. There's a lot of it's funny that there is only one of these entitled Secrets, because in a lot of ways that's what the Sith have here. They are so closely guarded that you get the sense that not only are there plots within plots, wheels within wheels, but there's a lot of self-deception going on as well. I mean, Sela sees herself as being able to fulfill this idea of wiping out the Red Sith and continuing the ascendance of humans within the Sith that Ludo Kresh had expected. Yaru sees himself as the founder of this culture that will hold the Sith together, even though there's so much fracturing in it. You know, you've got Adari thinking that somehow she and her people will be able to rise up against the Sith when they're so much more powerful. She's not able to fully pull that off by the end. Yes, she's able to strand some of them. Yes, she's able to turn the tables on them to a degree, but not nearly as much as her people would have wanted. Certainly, it doesn't free the Kashyyyk overall. So step by step, there's a lot of these angles that we get, and for a third-person book, we see just enough to make it work. It's a lot like writing a detective story or writing a mystery, where you don't want it all to necessarily be first-person because you can't get other perspectives in there. But at the same time, you don't want to give away the mystery. You know, you don't want to give away what's going on, but you can certainly have characters speculate amongst the narration that's going on either within their own head or while you're focused on that character. From a writing standpoint, he plays that very well. And it's funny because I didn't feel like we had that much in terms of depth to the motivations of Kara Holt in Knight Errant in the novel Knight Errant. It seemed like in a lot of ways she sort of fell somewhat flat. She was sort of just sort of the petulant child in a lot of ways. She didn't really build up quite as much. And these characters, given less time in the span of the overall book, wind up feeling as though they have more depth and more facets to them, perhaps, than Kara did, at least when we were first introduced to her, in the other time that we've seen prose fiction from John Jackson Miller.
Well, Nida especially, I mean, by the end of Savior, I mean, she really comes out of nowhere. You're really wanting to know what was going to happen next with her character, and then it jumped forward 1,000 years. So I'm like, no! Oh, I was really enjoying her. We had the Skyborn Rangers. She was kind of like the leader of Rogue Squadron, in a sense. I mean, you know, going back to Coruscant having this grand plan, I mean, the reading of his will was something big. It was kind of like they had to spring their trap before, you know, that was out in the open, before anyone knew what was in the will, kind of thing. And as it turned out, you know, we find that out after his death, he tries killing Jiraid and doesn't get around to it. You know, he wasn't able to succeed. He ends up dying, and that happens off page. But Nida talks about it because she then kills her brother. And I love how, you know, she also talks, she goes, I hated to use Portona like that, but he had something that I wanted. And, you know, I mean, it's like, even she's got some good to her. I mean, she didn't like, you know, deceiving, you know, the little helper, the guy that had a crush on her, in a sense. You know, and then she goes on, and I love how she's talking about the Final Testament. She goes, we just had the reading of the Final Testament. He commends his legacy to me, and the three surviving High Lords have ratified it. So you see, you are the mother of the new Grand Lord. Congratulations. Or until the Sith come to rescue us. You know, and I love how, like, she doesn't even care if the Sith come, because, of course, you know, she's going to have it all set. But it goes into Coruscant's foresight for the Sith here, about how she continues on. Perhaps you should hear the rest of Father's final wishes. Henceforth, on the death of the Grand Lord, that person's spouse and his household laborers would be sacrificed. And he got the idea actually from an old Kashyyyk custom. And I like that, because that, in a sense, eliminates a lot of the worry that any Grand Lord is going to have about your family trying to kill you. Because if you die, they're going to die too. And I thought it was a very Sith way, and yet the fact that it was a Kashyyyk kind of thing where they were able to, you know, oh, it's our own traditions kind of thing. I mean, again, it's the wool over their eyes kind of thing, hiding in plain sight that the Sith always do. And that was something that I liked about how at the beginning, how when Coruscant realized what he could pull off with Adari, you know, and they would go off on their walks and he would tell her all about science and physics and this, that, and the other things that she suspected, but everyone labeled her a heretic to even try to go to. I liked how, you know, there was, again, that wheel within wheels. You know, it's definitely one of the reasons why I like any story with John Jackson Miller's name attached to it. So far, I haven't read one that I've really been upset with. I've enjoyed everything. Every time I've thought, well, what's going on? You know, there's a part of me that dislikes this kind of lead you by the nose, and then you get a little treat, and then you've got five other things pulling you in other directions that you're like, well, what are the answers? John Jackson Miller always pays off. And that is what I really like about his stories, is that there is always a payoff. If there's a loose thread or a plot open somewhere down the line, he has always come back. And I just love that. You know, again, hats off, kudos. I'm really enjoying the first half of this story. I'm really looking forward to our next episode where we discuss, you know, the second half. Maybe we'll even kick off how the first two kind of bridge, in a sense. I don't know. It's a really exciting book. If you haven't had a chance and you're reading and you're hearing this podcast, go out there and get it. I mean, you know, throw some money at it. It's a good story. I don't think you're going to regret it.
Yeah, and don't judge this by the previous Star Wars ebooks, because there have been Star Wars ebooks that just kind of felt like it was fluff, and in the grand scheme of things, don't really mean a whole heck of a lot. And you kind of feel like, yeah, I can tell this was written just because, well, they said, let's write another story as a bonus, you know? We've seen that from time to time. And you can say the same thing about some of the, I mean, I would say the same to a degree about the short story that appeared in the anniversary edition of Heir to the Empire that wound up, oops, this is how we're going to wrap up the story from, what is it, Choices of One, because we never wrapped it up previously. But it seems like the way that Star Wars has handled short stories in the past when they're in print is usually pretty well done. But when it comes to ebooks, a lot of times It hasn't had the positive reception that one would expect, because they feel like, as a companion to something else, they're just kind of fluff to be there. Yes, these ebooks were designed to be a companion piece to Fate of the Jedi, but they are in and of themselves a good saga and fun to read, especially if you have a chance to read them all straight through. It's interesting to see things like, you know, the way that the Sith take on the Kashyyyk religious beliefs, although, you know, who didn't see that one coming whenever they first start talking about it. But you also have more subtle things. You know, as you go along, you'll find that the name of the location of Pandemonium, the place where that takes place, there's the name that the Sith called it, and there's the name that the locals call it. And the Sith, not knowing when they first arrive what a lot of the names are of the landforms around them, they're naming stuff like the Ragnos Lakes and such, the Takara Mountains after Takara Corson. And they essentially are resettling a culture that feels familiar, yet has different terminology. We're used to the idea of youngling, and then Padawan, at least for Jedi, and then Knight, Master, and then maybe somebody winds up being on the Jedi Council, or perhaps the Grand Master of the Jedi Council. In their case, they have, instead of younglings, you have the Tyros, T-Y-R-O-S, apprentices, which we used to call Padawans before we found the word Padawan, and went, oh, that's what Lucas calls them now. We have sabers instead of knights. We have lords instead of masters, with there being 13 lords at a given time, approximately 7 high lords, and then, of course, the 1 grand lord. So we have their hierarchy, but no matter what else that he introduces, that John Jackson Miller introduces here, that is different, that is unusual, that is unique to these stories, it's all within a framework that feels like it makes sense. The same with the technology, which I mentioned really, really early on here, about how it's almost like the technology dips, and we have to see them come to terms and rebuild technology or rediscover technologies from scratch, because they just took for granted what they had before and spent so much time in fighting that they didn't take the time to figure out why do these things work, how do they work, so that they can build on them in the future. From a cultural perspective, from a character development, a generational perspective, these are handled very well. If you felt like when you were reading the ebooks, especially near the middle of the series, it was kind of, you know, plotting a little bit more than the earlier ones in the series, go back, get the collected edition, whether ebook or in print, give that a shot, because once you see it as a big picture, I think you're really going to appreciate this set of stories that otherwise a lot of times might not be given the same due alongside many of the other Star Wars full-blown novels. This is a better set of tales than several novels that I could point out of Star Wars that were released within about the last 10 years or so. So definitely give it a chance if you haven't yet, or if you stopped in the middle.
Real quick before we get off the subject, you know, I also liked how the Sabers, we saw them come about. Jared, he was the leader of the Sabers, whereas Nida was the leader of the Skyborn Rangers. But, you know, we're talking about the formats here. Let's put this in perspective for you. At this moment, I'm looking at the very last page of story in the book, and we have 385 pages. Now, every story up to the point that we have talked about in this podcast has been 4 chapters, okay? So the first half of that part is 4 chapters. When you get to Pandemonium, that is 16 chapters. It's not like it's just 4 more chapters here. I mean, you get 16 chapters. That's like having 4 extra stories of what you've been giving in ebook format. I mean, you know, there are those out there that are like, oh, it's just one story. But I mean, if you take it in that aspect, it could be 4 whole stories for you. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things. I wasn't upset because it fit on my bookshelf. I would admit, if it didn't, that would have been my one irk. But luckily, I've got my bookshelf set up in a timeline format. My top shelf happens to be 1/4 inch bigger than all the other shelves. Which, unfortunately for ARCs and those other premium trades, still wasn't big enough. But this one fit, and so I'm just like, okay, I won't complain about that. But for those of you out there that it doesn't fit, I do feel your pain, just not in this case.
You do also have to get over the idea, if you're going to go pick this up, of, well, man, I don't want to pay for a bunch of stories that I already got for free, man. That's crap. You got to buy these all over again just to get Pandemonium? That's bull, man. You know, just because we're Star Wars completists and we'll buy everything, now you're making us buy something over again. That's not cool, you know, Ultimate Sith Edition.
paper costs money, though.
But I think that in this case, I mean, you're getting something in print that has not been available in print at all before. Plus, you are getting a pretty substantial-sized story with Pandemonium. It's not short, as Mark just said. I mean, it is a substantial-sized story. Maybe not a $12 story or a $7 or whatever type of size story you could get elsewhere. But if you're really stuck on that mentally, think about this as you're buying something for a library. You're buying, like, your own library, not, like, a library. You're buying this in order to get Pandemonium. And the print versions of all those other stories that came before, they're just free. And for those who complain, well, if they were going to make us buy the last one, man, then why should they have given us the stuff for free in the first place? Question number one, would you rather them have charged us for the first eight and then released it like this so that we literally were paying multiple times? And two, would you have rather us not have gotten these stories until they were all collected at this point and not have had the background in our minds as we were reading things like Cross Current, the other sea, or when we were reading Fate of the Jedi? I think that usually I'm really skeptical about when we have things repackaged for us with a little bit of something new and then sold to us. How many times have we bought Star Wars on home video for that purpose? Yeah. But in this case, I think that having it in print, being able to read it all in one shot, not having the eye strain if you don't have an ebook reader, the size of Pandemonium, and just the overall quality gives us something here that is worth the money. And those of us who kind of look skeptically on some of the repurchasing type things we see with Star Wars, this is one of those cases where if it's an offender, it's not nearly the biggest offender that we've seen. We should just kind of swallow this one and say, okay, you know, I'll eat the fact that I've already downloaded these for free for some of this because I want to see the whole thing and I want to have this for my library. But it is a tough thing, I know, for some people. I think you take me back 10, 15 years ago, I would have been one of the most vocal people griping about this. But
ditto.
I guess I've chilled a little bit in my old age, well, as I'm nearing 33.
You said it. I mean, when you said it in a chat, I'm all, hey, man, well said. You know, not in print before. This is a first time in print. Now, when you see that, you think winning. I mean, and now the flip side of this is everything's going digital. Now you can get almost the entire library I have behind me all in digital, except for you got to pay $7.99 for each one of those books. So you get the free digitals in this case, plus you pay for this book. I don't know. I don't think it's a bad format. I like it. I mean, I want to get both digital and the paper, but I don't want to go away from the paper, and I like the way that they're finding ways to make paper books still relevant.
I will say that if I was switching around and I wasn't keeping my Star Wars library as physical books and I was instead going to buy the collected stories as an ebook, then I would still be griping. Then I would still be saying, why is it that we've got all these other eight for free and now I've got to essentially get a digital version of stuff I already have digital and pay $7 or whatever it is. I haven't looked up the price. Just to get Pandemonium, why can't they make that available digitally separately? Because I've already got the other ones digital. I think if you're a digital reader, there is still some room for complaint, and it'd be a valid one, I think, at least.
Well, I would think they at least should down the road offer Pandemonium as a digital copy, you know, even if it's at price.
Think about the hubbub, though, if they...
People are going to flip.
So now you're telling me that now I could have just bought Pandemonium when I paid for the whole price for this thing?
Well, what if they made Pandemonium $12, though? I mean...
There's never-before-published finale, Pandemonium. Oh, so this is the place we get the end. We got to buy this to get the end, but now we can't. That is the Force Unleashed Ultimate Sith Edition exclusive, but that's bullcrap Hoth DLC... that whole issue all over again. At least this doesn't say exclusive. It says never before published. I don't see anything anywhere that refers to Pandemonium as being exclusive to this volume, but...
It just says explosive.
Yeah, it would be explosive if they turned around and sold it separately.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that, you know, you got to think about as a collector. You know, if you're collecting the digital, you're collecting the hardcover, what matters to you? I mean, you know, they say if you want to protest about something, don't buy it. You know, I will continue to buy my Star Wars books because I've got to read the book to decide whether or not I like it. So that's where I sit. I think we're about out of time. So with that, remember you can find our show at www.starwarsreport.com as well as on our Facebook page, iTunes, Zune, and airing on Middle Earth Network Radio. If you liked our show, be sure to drop us a review on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. you can also go and like our Facebook page. We just hit 300, so the Fatal Alliance hardcover will be going out come Celebration 6. If you have not liked our page and you want to get in on the chance to win that book, go do so, because until the first day of Celebration 6, you can continue to like our page, and then we will do a random drawing for the one lucky winner there, and that'll get shipped out. And also, just fire us off an email. You know, we got our feedback email, our feedback episodes that come away from our email that we get. You send it to us, and we read it back. You can email us at beyondthefilms@starwarsfanworks.com, and be sure to interact with us on Facebook and Twitter at @SWBeyondFilms.
So, with all of that being said, once again, this has been Nathan P. Butler.
Mark N. Whistler.
Thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds.
Lost Tribe of the Sith. Some assembly required.